All right, good evening. Erev Tov, Chanukah Sameach, Freilichen Chanukah. I thought to myself this week, with the way that we've been looking in terms of what Rav Lau has been saying, that it fits very nicely to one of the answers to the famous question of Chanukah. This is like a quick Devar Torah, but it's just a nice thought. The question is always asked that the miracle lasts, there's enough oil for one day. In which case, the miracle only lasted for 7 days, not 8 days, right? We always talk about 8-day miracle. Well, enough oil for one day means the miracle, it burned for 8 days. It means 1 day regular, 7 days miracle. And therefore, why do we celebrate Hanukkah for 8 days? If it's celebrating the miracle, it should only be for 7 days, right? Why do we have the extra day? The extra day was the oil was regular oil. It was burning for a whole day. So this is a famous question, the Beis Yosef, and there must be at least in the hundreds, there's answers to this question. I've got a booklet at home with about 59 answers on it. All different things. And one of the answers given is by Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, who said like this. He said that the miracle of Chanukah is not a miracle of quantity, kamut, it's a miracle of quality, what we call in Hebrew, echut. And he said, what happened to the oil? He said, I always compare it to going into the gas station. Going to a gas station, you normally fill up irregular, but there is something called super regular, and then there's whatever the bottom price is for. I'm not quite sure. It's not diesel, but whatever it is. So you know the levels of petrol depend essentially on what's inside it. It can get souped up, and if you need it, if you have such a car that needs the extra oomph, as they say, you need to get the extra petrol. So what happened to the oil is that the oil had within it the natural ability to burn for one day, but it became supercharged, if that's the way to describe it. That's the miracle. The supercharging of the oil made it last for 8 days. So what happened was that even though the quantity of the oil remained the same, but the quality became totally different through the miracle of Chanukah. I hope that makes sense. That's why you celebrate Chanukah even on the first day. That change of quality was taking place right from the beginning. So you had essentially 1 day's oil, which became super quality oil, and then lasted for 8 days. It's a miracle, not in the quantity, but in the quality. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate to say that the kasha is still a very strong kasha.
Yeah, it's always...
That's why there's 58 other answers in your book.
Correct.
But does anyone mention the simple answer, that the miracle that they had any oil was the first day?
Was the first day.
7 days of the last day.
Yes. Yeah, there's even more interesting answer than that, which is that there's a version of the story which changes everybody's perception that they didn't even have enough oil, even afilu liyom echad. Not liyom echad, but afilu liyom echad. Girsa. In which case, the miracle was even on the first day, because he didn't have enough oil even for 1 day. But that changes the whole story, and people find that very difficult. You know, you afilu. But the point that I think that Reb Chaim wants to make is the idea of Chanukah being a celebration not of quantity but of quality, right? It's a celebration of Limud Torah. It's a celebration of light. It's a celebration of what the Chanukiah represents, and this is essentially what we've been saying with the story of Purim, because what we've been talking about is that the two main players that we associate with Mordechai and Esther come from no background as far as we're concerned. We don't know where they're coming from. And in the story, as we saw already in Perek Dalet, their quantity, if you want to call it that, becomes quality. I see exactly a kind of parallel event, that they become imbued with their sense of Jewishness, with their sense of responsibility, and they transform, like the Chanukah oil, they transform. And if you want to sort of, you know, this is homiletics, and you'll have to allow me to be a little bit of homiletics. I mean, it is Chanukah, and you're allowed to make droshes, but I thought that there was a nice theme here. The theme of what we're studying here is the idea of the quality of what we're celebrating. And it just reminded me what Rav Kook said. Rav Kook was talking about, they asked him in the beginning of the yeshuv, in the 20s and 30s, you know, how can you support the new yeshuv? There's so many irreligious people who are planting and sowing and coming and doing all the agricultural work. How can you be so supportive, right? They're not keeping Shabbat. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. And Rav Kook was always very much the idea of look at the quality of what they are. They have qualities. They may not have the qualities that we would like 100%, but within that commitment to the land of Israel, there is a tremendous quality which he could, you know, he could appreciate, and he wanted other people to appreciate. That's a great way of looking at the world, of trying to find the element of what we call echut, the quality that you find in every Jew. And it's something that, you know, we need to remember from time to time, the idea that everybody has qualities. Ideally, we'd love to see everybody keeping all the mitzvot, but you know, there are people who manage to achieve a lot of things, and they're not necessarily religious. And there are other people, unfortunately, with their religion, who really sort of, you know, achieve quite the opposite. So what I'm saying is that this idea of quality, I think, is really what Hanukkah is about, to a certain extent, and certainly what we've been saying in the Megillah, trying to link the two holidays together. So that's just a thought off the top of my head. I want to just also to backtrack a little bit on what we've been saying in the last week or two, because we spoke about the element, two elements. We spoke the element of fear. Haman is afraid of Mordechai, and we've spoken about that, and we're going to come to that yet again. And we spoke last week about the element, the historical continuation of the battle between good and evil, between Amalek and Am Yisrael. And one of the issues that we spoke about last week was this idea of machar, the idea that everything is happening on the next day. Esther says, she makes Suda number one, and then she says to them, when the king says to her, "What's sheilati bakashati? What is your request?" She says, "My request is come back tomorrow, all right, for meal number two," which is very odd. But again, if we understand that there is a historical precedent, that both with Amalek in the Torah and with Shaul HaMelech, when he was fighting Amalek, they both use the word machar, that it's got to be done on the morrow, on the next day. And the reason, again, you can understand, as we said last week, the Ibn Ezra says that she wanted an extra day for tefillah, an extra day for preparation, a spiritual preparation. Right? And in fact, we see that with Yoshua, that when he's preparing for the battles, one of the battles, it says, Vayolen, Banochal, Vayolen, or I think that's actually said by Shaul. But there's a similar expression in the Sefer Yoshua. I don't remember now the exact words. But the idea was that he spent the night studying before going to battle. He spent the night in Limud Torah. And one of the great, great things of the Hesder Yeshivot, the yeshiva boys that spend a year in yeshiva, then do army, and they keep that up for 5 years, is this incredible preparation for battle. I was in the Kolo program with a lot of Hezda boys who'd come back from Lebanon. Lebanon battles in 1982 and 83. And they spoke a lot about, you know, before they went into battle, what exactly they would do. And their Rosh Yeshiva were with them, and they it was really quite a remarkable discussion that we had. And a lot of it was revolving around Limud Torah. The way to prepare for a battle when you're, you know, sort of literally in the lap of God, you know, whether you're going to live or die in that circumstance, a lot of the preparation beforehand was in terms of learning, of studying. Before you go into the battle, to have that spiritual preparation for the physical battle. So those are two ideas which we saw last time. And I just wanted to sort of mention that because we're going to see them again. We're in the middle of chapter 5, Perek Hey. And I just hasten to add, we're on our ninth shiur, which really is quite staggering. One more next week, and then we'll take a break, Mitzvah Hashem, till after the vacation period. We'll come back in the end of January, please God. Hopefully finishing the Megillah by Purim. That's the plan. Hopefully. Purim is late. Yeah, that's true. So what we saw last week, we got to chapter 5, verse 8. And verse 8 is where Esther says to the king and to Haman, come to the Machar, the end of Pasachet, or Machar Esse Kedvar Melech. Right? Tomorrow I will fulfill, you know, everything that you've asked me, says Esther, but come back tomorrow. And at that point, Pasuk Tet, and what happens in Pasuk Tet is not now focusing on the king, which you might have expected, Achashverosh, we're actually going to be focusing on Haman. And it's interesting, because if you think about it, the king would have come out of the first Seuda being told, come back tomorrow, right? Put it very bluntly, he probably was a bit, how should we say, he wasn't very happy with that. All right, you know, he's a bit peeved, because what happened was, you know, she invited him specially, and he's there, And he has all of these doubts about Haman. Maybe Esther's colluding with Haman, or he's colluding with her to overthrow the king. You know, there was always that suspicion. And what happens next? Come back tomorrow. So from the king's point of view, it's very unclear what happens when he goes home, when he gets into bed and starts thinking about what happened in this particular suit. But what we do concentrate on, interestingly, is Haman. Okay, so I'm saying this because you'll see Rav Bachrach, one of the commentaries that I gave you here, is he picks on that point. And he does stress the point that Achashverosh at the moment is to the side. He'll come back in chapter 6, Balayla Ahu. Okay, which we know the famous, we changed the way we sing it, but it's also got this a significance of the word melech, which obviously we'll come to. But look at the end of chapter 5, and I just want to see here what exactly is going on with Haman, because there's a number of interesting things. Vayetze Haman b'yom ahu, posuk tet. Haman on that day leaves Esther's palace or whatever, samech v'tov lev, he's very happy. He's content. Ukira ot Haman et Mordechai b'shar melech, v'lo kam v'lo zami mena, but he sees Mordechai. And Mordechai doesn't get up, and he doesn't move. Vayimole Haman al Mordechai chema. Haman is absolutely livid with Mordechai. And that's interesting, because remember the beginning when we saw the disagreement between, it was am Mordechai. It wasn't just Mordechai, it was the people of Mordechai, which is the whole Gezerah. Now we're moving into a very personal disagreement between Haman and Mordechai. It seems to be that at this point, the fact that Haman is slighted by Mordechai to the point where he doesn't get up for him, doesn't recognize his existence, is something which the anger of Haman is very, very strong indeed. And as we'll see in a minute, we'll see the way Rav Bachrach explains it. There's more to say about this, but I just wanted to point that out. Now it's like very personal against Mordechai. And Yud, Vayitapak Haman. Haman holds back. Now again, you'll say to me, wait a minute, he's the knacker here, he's the big guy, and Mordechai is basically sitting there by himself. Haman could do away with him. Yeah.
No, he couldn't, because if he's going to the king the next day, he doesn't know what the deal with Esther is. He has no idea.
Correct, and even more than that, who saved the life of the king?
Yeah, that's right.
Esther and
the king would. What did you do with him?
Exactly. So at this point, Vitapak Haman is very, very significant, right? And all of this is again, we're going through the mind of this person. Haman is holding back because his natural inclination is to express his anger in the most direct way and hit Mordechai, kill him, and that'll be the end of it. But no, he's not going to do that. What does he do? Vayavol beito, he comes to his house. Vayishlach vayaveto avav vezeresh ishto, and he brought all the people together, his friends and his wife Zeresh. So he's going to have some sort of power. He's going to have some sort of, is it a celebration? Is it a party? What is going on? We'll see. Yudal, Vayisapalem Haman et Kavodosh Rov Banam. And Haman goes into a whole explanation to everybody sitting there. They know this. His wife for sure knows this. But he talks about his wealth and the number of children he has. He's very proud. And that he's been promoted. Everything for Haman is very, very sort of on the up. And it's interesting because we have Vayisaper that he starts telling in Yud Aleph, and then Vayomer is like, and again, almost if he has to take a breath. And he says, and this is the famous thing, Af lo hevia Esther Malkim Amelech al Amishter she'asta kimoti, that I was invited, only me, to go to Esther's party. V'gam lamachani kurulai Amelech, and tomorrow I'm going with Hamelech, with the king. And this is the pasuk which everybody jumps on. Yigimo v'chol zeh einenu shoveli. And I have to tell you that with all everything I've said till now, and you can imagine how excited he was on the one hand, he says it's not worth a dime. None of it is worth a dime. Why? B'chol eit ashani ro'et Mordechai Yehudi Yoshev b'shar melech. I see this Mordechai, the Jew, sitting there in the gate of the king. And I think the Vilna Gaon jumps on this, and everybody sort of says that this shows the pure evil of this man, that, you know, nothing would satisfy him. There's a famous statement, In the Gemara, which is actually on your page, when the Gemara asks, where does Homon exist in the Torah? Homon min ha-Torah minayin, right? And the Gemara answers, ha-min ha-eitz hazeh, from the tree of knowledge, right? You must not eat. That's what they were told in the Garden of Eden. So what's that got to do with Homon? And one explanation is very, very, very direct, but it's true, is that Homon was so much full of his own importance, and he had everything that he needed except one thing, the respect of Mordechai. And even though you don't need them, what does he want it for? You know, so one person doesn't bow down to you, big deal. The answer is for a man with such an ego like this, it is a very big deal. Because the one thing that he couldn't have is what he wanted. Like Adam standing by the tree, right? Everything that he had, that he needed, he had. The one thing that he couldn't have, he goes to the tree and starts complaining that that's what he wants. And of course, eventually, that's what happened, that he got enticed to do it, and then, you know, the rest is history, as they say. So that's the kind of theme that we're seeing here with Homon, his incredible arrogance, and the fact that out of everything that he's been rewarded with on this day, kol zeh einenu shoveh li, none of it is worth a dime. Unbelievable statement. Yeah.
Yeah, it says that Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate.
Yeah.
But he had rent his clothing and he wasn't permitted there.
Well, it's maybe outside the king's gate. He was nearby. He certainly was distancing himself a little bit, but he wasn't going to leave because he still felt responsible for Esther and what's going to be, and he wanted to keep an eye on that. But you know, he's wearing this clothing, so he's got to be careful with that. Yeah. 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 And I'm glad you asked the question, because I'm going to just say something here which I actually did not put on the page. But Bachrach, Rabbi Shua Bachrach, writes about this, and he says like this. He says something fantastic. He says that we always talk about Nes Nista. Purim is the hidden miracles, right? And he says that, what is the definition of Nes Nista? Nes Nista is where you get a whole bunch of events which all seem to be very logical things that happen, or very in the run of the mill sort of things. But when you put them all together, then all of a sudden it becomes miraculous. All right? You know, the fact, I mean, I always think of the beginning of the Six-Day War. There were certain events that there was a build-up, and then there was this happening, and then, you know, the air attack at the beginning, which wasn't an air attack, Israel preempted it, and then all of that news sort of came together. Then as the news started to build, to roll on, and become more and more, we became more aware of the facts, one thing after the other rolled together, became an incredible sense of, wow, we're witnessing a miracle. Okay, and again, if those of you remember that, those few days of the war, it was unbelievable. And that's the sense of what's going on here. He, again, Rabbi Bachra says, what happens if he hadn't seen Homan hadn't seen Mordechai on that day? What happens if the suggestion, as we're going to have now, to make the tree, and he hadn't called his family together? What would have happened? And then there wouldn't have been the suggestion to make the tree, which of course becomes the way that Homan is quickly done away with. Because the fact that the tree is ready and everything else, take him on the tree and hang him. Charvoina. Alright? What would have happened if Charvoina wasn't standing there to suggest it? He's not one of the big tzaddikim, Charvoina. Zochalato, for one thing only. I think that's a lesson in life. Sometimes, you know, you have your 1 minute of fame and you get a bracha for it. Sorry? Sha'achas. In this case, in one second, you know. He said one thing and then he gets mentioned in Shoshana Siaka. It's unbelievable. Chavon is not one of the friends of the Jewish people. No way. Alright, whatever it is. Let me just read this to you because it is so interesting. I'm sorry I haven't got it on the page, but I'll just read what he says here. The miracle is what's going on here, is what's going on behind the scenes. We feel the miracle only when all of these events come together. Normally these things seem to be regular. What if you take them in isolation, each of these events? It basically runs according to the nature of the people who are doing these things. And he says, for instance, at the Begisha Zot Shel Haman in Mordechai, When Haman here meets Mordechai, b'shahi ha'hi anachona, at that particular moment, v'et kol asher yotzei mizeh, whatever comes out of it, b'vadai shelo yachla Esther ledamot. Esther could never have imagined this was going to be the consequence, kashay chinat ha'mishter, when she was preparing her meal. That while that she was preparing meal number two, Haman was going to bump into, well, not quite bump into, he was going to see Mordechai, and he was going to be, you know, so full of his own importance, and then Chose and then a Shoveli, and make this incredible statement. And all of that is happening, coming together to make the nace. And I think this is such an important point. This is our lives today. Everything around us, and so many of the rabbis write about this, is an appreciation of nace. Right? Teva, the famous thing of the Ariza. What did the Ariza? I haven't got a whiteboard here, but you can imagine it. You write up the gematria, hateva. You got to play around with the gematria a little bit. You write the word hateva, nature, with an extra hey, comes to 86. And you write the word Elohim, aleph, lamed, hey, yud, mem, 86, God. And essentially what the Ari is trying to tell us in his own way is that, you know, what we call nature is essentially the miracles of God, you know, around us. My daughter just came back from Israel. She did the Masada thing. She did white water thing in the north. I never knew you could do that in Israel. White water, green water. I don't know where it is. Hiking and you name it. It was unbelievable. She needs 2 weeks vacation after coming back from Israel. But that's the reality of taking 11th grade kids to Israel. But the reality of all of that is that she said you go up to the top of Masada. That sunrise, it just is overwhelming. And it happens every single day. Rav Dessler says, why then do we not appreciate it? And he says the answer is because it happens every single day. We get used to it. We don't see the nace. We don't see the nace in Teva. Teva to me is, someone explained to me once, it's the program. Right? We're in a big computer here, and the program is Teva. But it's got to be programmed by somebody. And we have to appreciate that the Teva, that nature, is programmed by the great programmer in the sky, if you want to explain it like that, to carry on the comparison. And this is all coming together in the story of Megillas Esther. It's very special. It's an awakening for us to understand that in our lives, particularly in the Gola, where we have such precarious existence over so many years. I mean, thank God in America today we feel very secure. I hope that continues. Who knows what will be for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, if this is going to be the same situation. We just don't know. But at the moment, it seems, but this is what the Jews said in Spain, like 150, 200 years before the expulsion, they said the same thing. So comfortable, and they were doing so well, and they were in the universities and doctors and everything else. So we know Jewish history. We know the issues there. But in the Gola, the issue of recognizing the Yad Hashem, the hand of God, in everything that's going on with us is something which Megillah is there to give us that little push in that direction. And I thought that was the point that Abe was asking, and I wanted to sort of expand on that. All of these events that we're going to be reading from now right through to the end all seem to be on their own, almost to be logical, but when you put them all together, kapow, it's a miracle par excellence. It's an incredible experience. And I think that's a point that I wanted to make today as a kind of initiation when we get to chapter 6, Balayla Ahu, and we start going into fifth gear, and we start moving so quickly through the whole story. It's important to appreciate that particular point, how all of these events singly may not necessarily be so amazing, but when you put them all together into this story, it becomes an incredible appreciation of Nace Nista, the idea of a hidden miracle. So that's a good point. I'm pleased you gave me the segue to talk about that. But listen to this. Yudala, we're just going to finish the chapter here. So as a result of his particular gripe against Mordechai, his wife and all of the friends say, Yasu Eitz Gavah Chamishim Amo. You really want to do something to make sure that, you know, you really want to take away Mordechai, then the way to do it is to make a tree 50 amas high. It's 100 feet. That's very tall. Ubabokem olamela. Tell the king in the morning, right, tomorrow, because you're going to see the king. Vayitlu et Mordechai alav uva im hamela. In other words, you're not making the decision. You tell the king and make sure that, you know, he agrees with you. Then you can go with the king. Ela mishdes sameach to the party, very happy. Vayitav adov b'lifnei hamon v'yasa eitz, and he made the tree. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. the significance of that. There is a fantastic commentary, I haven't spoken about it yet, called the, it, here it's just called Targum, but there is Targum Sheni, different Aramaic commentaries, and this particular piece, if you have the small book, page 31, there's a very long piece for a short part of the Hebrew text, you can see the Aramaic goes on and on. And the reason why it goes on and on here, and he brings fantastic midrashim. And here, the reason why, it's unbelievable. What Zeresh and Ohavav, all of the friends of Haman, were discussing is how do we kill this Jewish guy? If we want to drown him, the Jews cross the Red Sea. If we want to kill him another way, they got out of that situation. It goes through, it's unbelievable what they said. You know, just trying to sort of, I went through this today, and it's staggering. I know there is a midrash in Hebrew like this as well. It says if you want to, in the end they decided to hang him because they felt that that was the way that you know he wouldn't be able to get out of it. But before that, the a whole bunch of suggestions how to kill him. These are not very nice people. They said if we throw him into the sea, then they've already crossed the sea. If we put him into a fiery furnace, then we know Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, this is after those events, they came out of the fiery furnace. If we put him into a lion's den, then Daniel came out of the lion's den. In other words, they go through all of the history, they know all the Jewish history, right? Like the Nazis, they knew everything about the Jewish calendar, and they used that against the Jews during the war. It's disgusting what they did. I mean, Purim was, in fact, the interesting thing was when they were on trial in Nuremberg, there's a famous statement made by Goering before he was Purimfest, because it happened around that time, and he called it a Purim, and there were ten of them.
To the lottery, like, you know, which debt is not immune to.
Yeah, it's
the lottery that. So which months they didn't have.
And which month, correct. I mean, when we see this and we see the description of the AIDS, we have to realize this is after a long, protracted discussion of which other methods of getting rid of Mordechai were completely ruled out. It's unbelievable. And the amount of knowledge, according to the Targum here, based on Midrash, of Jewish history is staggering. Absolutely staggering. I want to show you a couple of things on the page I gave you because this is really something special. The language of the people here, Vayisaper Haman, right, what we saw, it's just over here. Vayisaper Haman, we saw that, just one second, Posa Yudala. Vayisaper Haman, Lehem Haman et Kavod Asher Averog Banav. One second, where is he referring to here? Oh, Perek Vav Pasuk Yud Gimel. This is later on, after Haman comes back from the debacle with the king. It's on the page in front of you. This again is taken from Rav Lau. The first section over here, section A. All right, and Rav Lau writes like this, because the theme of Amalek and the language of Amalek comes through in this particular part of the story as well. And I just want to make that clear. Look at this. I just want to read a little bit of it, and it's relevant to what we saw now, but even more so to the next chapter. But again, it's a theme which I said we saw before, and I want to continue it. So have a look at this, just section A, very quickly, the first couple of lines. Hamila hamachonenet et haprakim ha'ela. Hi mikra. This is the language which comes now through the chapters, and we'll point it out as we go along. Mikra means by chance. Things that happen by chance, which is the Ashkofa, which is the whole worldview of the Amalekite. The Amalekite represents that everything is by chance, there's no order in the creation, there's no control. Yeah. Asher Korcha Baderech, back to the original, and exactly what he's going to quote here. Look at this. Chachamim, the end of the first line, Kavar, Somo Einam al Divrei Haman, this is the next chapter, but it's kind of relevant there, and we're talking about it. I just wanted to bring it in that when the whole story with the horse, the language of kara, kuf resh hey, and this of course is one of the words that is used in the tochacha to describe when Am Yisrael move away from God. Right, imata olech b'keri, ani olech b'chamas keri, God says that if you want to move away from recognizing the hand of Hashem in your lives, then I will make it even worse for you. All right, and this is the expression that is used, kara, Makara, you say in Hebrew, what's up? What's happening? And that's the expression in modern Hebrew, but in the Torah it's got a loaded nuance. The nuance of mikre. Mikre is something which has happened by chance and is clearly something which becomes the, how should we say, the symbol of what Amalek represents. Go down to after that heavy black print. Zoapa mishniya b'megillah shemafiya b'amila kara. This is the second time we see this word. Hapam rishona perik dalet. We actually had it in last chapter. Kesher Mordechai shemet kol asher nasa lidei Haman. When Mordechai hears everything that happens through Haman, v'hu ma'avir et ha'bsura la'tach. Remember, we spoke about this guy, the court person, the chamberlain or whatever, who was running backwards and forwards. She is saper le'Esther. Mordechai says to tell Esther. Vayagilo Mordechai et kol asher karahu. Tell him everything that is karahu. And this, of course, is a loaded word because it's also inferring karahu in the sense of who is making it happen. Who is bringing it upon us? The people who believe in mikra. The people who believe in things that happen by chance. Bo chachamim b'midrash, and the rabbis talk about it in the midrash. Esther Rabbah, and v'dosho t'mila zo, they explain the word. Amala tach lechem ola ben beno shel karahu. It's the grandson of those who believe in the word karahu. Ba lechem harehu dama shel karacha bader. Exactly. It says in the midrash, quoting from the story of Amalek, these are the people shel karacha. Right, that they made it happen. Interesting, Rashi plays on the word. Over there, remember the story Rashi brings of the man who jumps in a hot bath, right? Boiling hot, and the man wants to lower the temperature, so he's going to be the korban, and other people can, you know, once he jumps in, the temperature goes down, karacha, to make it cold. But the idea is, the same idea, that by being the first one to challenge and to have the chutzpah to stand up before the God of Israel in such a direct way, that becomes something which is established for Dorot. And Rav Soloveitchik argues so strongly that in our generation, there is a Amalek comes along again and again, be it in the form of the Nazi, be it in the form of the Iranian, be it in the form of whoever. Right, even sort of certainly in the Hamas and the terror and everything else that we have to go through today. These are just new forms of what we can only describe in traditional terms as the people Asher Korcha Baderech, the people of Mikre, the Amalekites. And the Rav was very, very insistent on that. Listen to this. I'll just read again a little bit more of Rav Lau. Of what he says here. Midrash says, like halfway down on the right hand side. Mevakesh lechaded et ha'ayin el mikre ha'sholet b'mamlacha hazo. In this whole story, in this whole kingdom, there was a lot of belief in the idea of mikre. Things happen by chance. Yesh karo kadmoni shu amolek, and it obviously comes from the idea of amolek. Ha'poyol lelo le'ut lahar'il et ha'olam ba'arso. He wants to poison the whole world. Who pogeh b'Yisrael b'seitam in Mitzrayim? He attacked the Jews when they came out of Egypt. V'ofech ledegem shel sinah la'yudim, and he becomes the symbol of hatred, anti-Semitism. Sinah she'ein lo peshe v'ein lo gvul. It has no explanation and it has no limit. The illogical hatred. What did I write on the back here? Anti-Semitism. The illogical hatred. Right? Doesn't make sense. And the more people sort of try and explain it, the more illogical it becomes. Some people put it down to jealousy. It's something innate. The Rashi brings this from the Gemara, Halacha, Esav Sonet Yaakov, which I don't believe every single non-Jew hates Jews. I don't believe that's what it means. But it's Halacha. It's one of those things which is like established as a law, as a holech. Something which goes through life that you will find in the world people who don't like Jews. For reasons so diffuse and so different that sometimes you just don't know why, what, where, or how, where it all came from. And it's there. It's illogical hatred. And it's certainly been around for a long time. And learning through the story of Purim, this is where it becomes very significant. We will, Mitzvah Hashem, not this half of the semester. Next semester we'll talk a bit about the challenge that Esther had to write down the whole story. Because the rabbis were worried it wouldn't create more anti-Semitism. Writing this all down was going to create a big problem. And she had to fight the rabbis, yes.
Right. We had discussed the possibility that I and Haman were generals together. And there was
we're going to talk about, yeah. Yes,
but if you take that away and just go to the straight story, it even makes even less sense.
Yeah.
That even for the hatred.
Yeah.
But if you throw that out and say that,
then there's absolutely no logical reason whatsoever, and that's something that we have to live with. We have to explain. It's one of the hardest things to explain to a child. You know, I met a lot of people over the last few summers who were refugees originally from Germany and from Austria, and they all talk about their experiences in school during the 30s, when they were literally beaten up for no apparent reason whatsoever. They said at the beginning you couldn't get your head around it. Why your friend all of a sudden became your worst enemy, right? And they all talk about the same kind of experience, and eventually, of course, the schools were barred for Jews, and they had to make Jewish schools. So this is kind of a strange irony that was going on, that kids were getting a Jewish education, not because the parents wanted to give them that, but they had no other choice. They had to keep them separate from everybody else as part of the law of the land. It was very odd. It's very odd. And it's very hard to explain it. It's just, you know, there's no obvious reason, no obvious rhyme or reason for it. We'll come back to Rav Lau, because I just wanted to make that point, the continuation of the Amalek theme, which we saw last week, Machar. And now we're going to see in terms of the language, the word kara, which we're going to look out for. And look at section B. Section B, I wanted to show you, which is brought by Rav Bachra, is the same story of Haman and Mordechai meeting each other, but not in the context of the army. I wanted to show you this because I've mentioned this before, that midrashim chalukim. There is this concept that midrash can differ in terms of the circumstance. There are different opinions about what went on. We saw originally that Mordechai and Haman met each other as generals in the army, and Haman ran out of supplies, and we said that Mordechai made him into an eved, said that, you know, if you sell yourself, I become your owner, as it were, you become my servant, then I will give you what you need, and he did. And this was what Mordechai then used against Haman again and again. Look at this. This is coming from a different source, from the Yalkut Shimoni. And this is a different version of the story, but it's fascinating. Just to give you this concept of different concept, but the same idea. Omru, this is section B on the left-hand side. Lo lechinam hayu mitkotim ela k'tata k'duma hayta b'nei. Really, there was an old argument between Mordechai and Haman. What was it? K'shahayu b'nei Yisrael bonim chomat Yerushalayim. Different context. They were in the process of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. It fits into Rav Ben's timing beautifully, because he said that the whole Purim story is after the Jerusalem reclamation, if you want to call it that, began for the Second Temple. They started rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. B'yimei Ezra, in the days of Ezra. Bo aleim hasoni'im. There were certain people who were against the whole project. Umanu otam livnot, and they prevented them from building. Third line. V'amru lahem. Shelo b'rishut ha-melech atem bonim. You're doing it without a permit, right? Where have we heard that before? V'heim omrim. Ein onu bonim ela b'rishuto. They argue we're building with a permit. Here it is. They maybe waive something. Amru lahem asonim. So the enemies said, biru mikem echad. We need one person to represent you. V'anu nivdo lanu echad. We will have one person representing us. We'll go to the king, we'll go to Achashverosh, and we'll have, for want of a better word, a din, equivalent of a din Torah, if you want to call it that. Biru umoto olam velo matsu ish miyuchad berishut kamana rasha. Who did they choose? Haman. All right, he was their representative. As I said, a completely different context, but you'll see the same idea. V'Yisrael biru lehem Mordechai v'asulehem. And of course they had to travel wherever they were going, and they made provisions, and they went, Haman and Mordechai together, with presumably some accompaniment, to go to the king, to go to Achashverosh, to argue the rebuilding project should continue or not. Now what happened? Vaya Mordechai at Tzadik. Ochel pito ma'at ma'at. Mordechai had his bread a little bit every day. He was very smart. Didn't eat all his food in one go. Kamosha omru chachamim ha'malach b'dera lo yochel yotim mishnei ra'avon. In other words, you should eat rations very limited when you're traveling on a journey to make sure you have enough food. V'homon ha'rosha, v'homon ha'rosha. Ochel v'lo ishgiach. He just ate and took no notice how much. And of course, you can see what's going to happen. Chose mazone. He ran out. Haman ran out of food. Same idea, right? The two generals ran out of food. Here, it's the two lawyers ran out of food. Here, they're lawyers. I don't want to comment on lawyers. But I love Omer, and it says, "In Mishle ubeten rishayim techsa." The stomach of the Rasha, the stomach of the evil man, is lacking because he just presses, right? That's the difference between Essen in German, and fressen. And he was a fresser. Kivan shalom matzah pat bederech lechol. So Haman was looking for bread. There was no shop right on the way. So what did he do? Ba'alo etza Mordechai. So he goes to Mordechai and says, Mordechai, give me some bread. Lend me a loaf of bread. And he begged him. Mordechai said, no, I don't want to lend you a loaf of bread. It's your problem. And in the end, he said, I'm giving you a loaf of bread. Sell yourself to me. Unbelievable. For a loaf of bread. Wow. Makes it even more, Haman even more of a sleazy character than he was before. And Haman says, yeah, I'll do it, I don't care. What has it got echoes? This is much closer to the original Esav Yaakov, right? Selling himself for a pot of lentils. So interesting. The theme, history, running through this. Machar, tomorrow, Karal, Esav, Yaakov. You know, it gives you the chills how this sort of whole historical, you know, sort of force comes through the story in ways that you don't even expect. And look at this. It goes on. But they didn't have a piece of paper to write down that Haman had sold himself as a servant to Mordechai. Write on my shoe. Right? So Mordechai said, write on my shoe, you sign it, it says you are my servant, and then sign your name. And there was a reference to shoes in the other story. Miyad katav amana sandalosha Mordechai, ani amana gagi, he wrote the following nusach, they give the whole story. I, the Agagite Haman, avdosha Mordechai Yehudi, I'm the servant of the Jew Mordechai, shenim karti lo bekika lechem achat, I was sold him for a loaf of bread. Now what happened in our story where Mordechai was sitting and Haman goes by, what does Mordechai do? And it's so interesting. He shows off his shoe. He lifts his foot and he sort of waves it in Haman's face that you're my servant, I'm not getting up for you, not in a month of Sundays, go and get lost. And this is what happened here. Haman becomes the great leader or whatever. The kavatz mo avodah zara, he makes himself into an idol. Mordechai was sitting there. And he was coming and going or whatever. Because he saw Haman going past. He would stick out his foot. Unbelievable. But sandal with his shoe, and it had the whole nusach on the bottom of the shoe. And Haman got very upset, got very angry for obvious reasons. But wow. This is so, again, very interesting, the themes of this midrash, but I as I say, it's got a stronger connection to the original story of Yaakov and Esav, and I think maybe that's why there is this different nuance in the midrash. This is not generals in the army, these are prakletim, as they say, these are representatives of their different groups, and it's the same idea of selling, being sold for whatever purpose. And again, just a little bit more of midrash. What is again? This is coming from a different midrashim on Esther. Omar Haman, these four lines. Shema Yozuz Mordechai Melefanai. Maybe Mordechai will move when I go past. For who lozaz? Mordechai did not move. But Yimalech Haman Mordechai Cheme got very angry. Ubotosha Chashava Rosha Belibo Vamas. So what did Haman think at that moment? Ani Yochol Vaatobim Komovi Amod. I should kick him and they'll kill him. He'll die. What I'm going to do, I'm going to hang him that everybody can see. Lamed bo adam, dis, whatever that word is, shali et chozek shina. I want to show off my strength. In other words, that I am now so powerful that I can arrange the death, the execution of Mordechai that will be seen by, as you say nowadays, the whole world, CNN, BBC, everyone's going to be there. The whole works. That's the 100. Amod, the 50, Chamishim Amod, which is 100 feet, right, of tree that they're going to hang him on because he wants it to be a national spectacle. And this is, again, so interesting. It gives you this concept of what Haman is about. But as I said, I found the whole contrast of the two midrashim very, very interesting. Yeah.
Rabbi, it's probably the appropriate time to repeat my questions from like.
Yeah.
All this relationship that they have before, with all these emunations that Mordechai felt that he have against Haman and everything. So how come from all of that he's getting the defeated roles you know, and just puts like a sack on his in his things, and he just like, you know, he's not going for a fight. He's looking for some kind out of sources, like, you know, to win this battle. How come with all this relation that they have, he have so many things about Haman? He say, hey, you step, you know, hold on. I'm as important as you are. And he doesn't take anything with it to the kingdom and try to change that. And on the other hand, instead of that, he take a very passive role and, I don't know, discover God again.
And that's in terms of Mordechai. From the side of Mordechai, I think we will answer that. We will come to that when we see a bit more of how the story plays out. From the point of Haman, we're going to say exactly what we said a few weeks ago, that humafached, he was afraid of Mordechai. There is this theme, and he says it now straight in section C, the next paragraph, that there is this continuation of the sense that Haman is really beneath the surface. He's really scared of Mordechai. He's scared of him. And therefore he doesn't want to take the initiative over here, obviously for reasons which we said before, that he can't say to the king, hang him, because...
How come Mordechai is not standing up now?
But again, I think Mordechai is in a position where he's umachakeh, he's waiting for what will be in terms of, you know, the Yad Hashem. He sees that there's got to be something going on here. There's going to be a nes, or ein simcha la nes. But at the same time, he's done hishtadlut. He sent Esther into the palace, and then that side of things is happening. And I think he feels at this point, ze maspik, right? That's enough. I think that's the way it goes. But what is so interesting is the suggestion that Haman, with all of his, you know, sort of grand ideas, is really male pacha. He's really scared. He's really afraid. Yeah, well, your points are excellent. Yeah.
I have to disagree on Mordechai. Nothing was a sure thing to Mordechai, because until the Laila Ahu, and until Mordechai is taken by Haman through the city, and until Hargona, and until the Malach pushes Haman, nothing was a sure thing.
Nothing was a sure thing,
until,
correct.
Until the Yayin and Bihuzet, the Ezehu.
Yeah.
So Mordechai couldn't take it for granted. And in fact, it is showing that even Mordechai, with the star, the great Jew that he was,
doesn't see that.
Sure
enough. Not even.
Maybe he saw it, but nothing in Golas. Nothing is sure.
Nothing is sure in Golas. And that's the point I was going to say. Absolutely. It's a lesson about Galut. I'm just looking at the number. We've got missing one for a minute. Should we call somebody in? I think we need, because we can dharma. Try Stewie. Yeah, Stewie might come out. Yes, if we'll keep just up, you know, sort of till we finish this particular point. Look at section C. I just want to show you this. Haman yodea gam yodea. Haman knows mahu rotzel lasot b'Mordechai. What he wants to do to Mordechai. V'neno yachol ki hu odena mafached. As we said before, he's still afraid. Et pachdo ze kvar ra'inu perigimel v'yivez be'inav lishloach yab Mordechai levado. Mordechai saved the life of the king. So Haman doesn't want to attack Mordechai directly. So how can he ask the king to kill Mordechai? In other words, maybe Haman is part of the conspiracy against the king, and instead of killing Mordechai, what would the king do? He's so unpredictable, he'll end up killing Haman, which is what happens anyway, but Haman doesn't want to take that particular risk. So it's so interesting, there's play within play, there's chashash, there's doubts going in one direction.
He doesn't take
doubts
the recommendation of his wife and his friend.
Well, he does in the sense of the tree. That's what he does do. Just turn over and I'll show you something very interesting. I've written here, hang 'em high. Remember that? Wasn't that a spaghetti movie, or what they called it? Spaghetti westerns in those days. Oh, was it? Sorry? Clint Eastwood, I'm sure it was. But I had to put that in because it just amused me. Listen to this, because it's so interesting, this whole thing of the tree. The top of the page. Lama yatsu lo lasota etzu lama gavar kocha. So why did the wife and all the friends say, you know, put the tree so tall? So again, quoting from Midrash, Mara omer litloto. What was the whole point? Ela omer shemikol davar Kodesh Boruch Hu Yochel Atzilam. As I said, God will save them from everything. Hitzil et Avraham min ha'esh. He saved Abraham from the fire. All right. Later on, the other midrash says different characters. Hitzil Yitzchak min ha'akedah. Et Yaakov min ha'malach. You know, all the others were saved from dangerous situations. Et Moshe mecherev Paro. Moshe was saved from the sword of Paro. Yisrael min ha'yam. Israel was saved from the sea. Et Daniel migavaro. Daniel from the lion's den. And min ha'etz eino yochol atzil. But when it comes to min ha'etz, no, that is not somewhere something that you can save. How should we say you can save Mordechai from? Ha'min ha'etz, and that's what we're going to come to in this discussion. Look at section E, and I'll just show you this because we mentioned it before, and it is unbelievable. Remez to Haman in the Torah, section E, because we just mentioned ha'min ha'etz. Rabbanan. The Taman Amrin, the rabbi said over there, meaning I think in Eretz Yisrael, Minayin lahoma min haTorah. They asked the question, where is Haman in the Torah? Shneimag says in the Torah, Mihigid lecha ki erom ata min haEid sashed siviticha levilti achomimenu achalta. In other words, achalta. So the question was, how did you know that you were naked? So the answer was because you must have. God said you must have eaten from the tree. Dorshu Haman, Hamin Haman. That word Hamin is explained as Haman. What's going on here? Listen to this. Again, Yeshua Bachach was an amazing thinker. He saw this historical continuity in ways that I just can't begin to explain to you. It's just unbelievable. He says like this, and we just referred to this, the whole idea of the tree. Hamimei Bereshit, from the days of creation, he says, Meshucha Eivazov Shebein Haman Ubein Mordechai. The history of anti-Semitism goes back to the beginning of the world. That is pretty depressing. But I suppose you have to say there is a purpose to it. And I don't know, I just feel sometimes the only reason why Jews stay as Jews is not, unfortunately, because they choose to be, but because they're forced to be. This is one of the, again, ironies of anti-Semitism, but that's for another time. But he says, Miyom ha'etzahu. From the moment that tree was planted, as it were, Asher frid b'meira, bein ato bein ara, which distinguished between good and evil, excuse me, v'nidnam l'milchama mido do, there's been a sense of battle between good and evil. This is Star Wars, right? Between good and evil, every generation. Hu yishuv charosh v'ata tushufenu, okay. Right? This is the description of the man and the nachash. Man and the snake. So ki Haman mizera amaleku. Haman is from the seed of Amalek. He comes from the background of Amalek. V'shorasho yonek. Where's his shorash? What is this? What is the root of Haman? Unbelievable! This mizuamat oto nachash. It's from the poison of the original nachash, the original snake. Ashei gid laAdam haRishon, who said to Adam, ki erom ata, that you are naked. What does that mean? Listen to that. And this is where it gets a bit Kabbalistic. I'm not making apologies for this, but it's just unbelievable. Hanachash haya arom mikol chayat ha-sadeh. We know that the nachash was the... Arom is here is used in the sense of the cunning, the most cunning of all the animals. And says, again, this is from the Zohar, V'okama irbuvin inun bishin bi'iran v'chiyun. There are many, the Zohar comments, there are many mixtures, many conflicts, right, which are very bad. So why does Nachash get singled out as being the worst of those particular forces against us? But he says, reason is, there is this sense that the Nachash represents the forces, the negative forces from the non-Jewish world, the kulam or ravim b'Israel who attack themselves, attached to Israel to attack them, the aim b'chulahon arur kamalek shu nachash ra. What we're saying here is that this battle between Mordechai and Haman essentially goes back to the Garden of Eden, to Yimei Bereshit. It's unbelievable. And you know what? Maybe this is what we're going to have to say when it comes to trying to explain, if you can explain it, the whole essence of what this Megillah is about, the idea of mindless hatred against the Jews. And where is it coming from? As I said over here, anti-Semitism, the illogical hatred. Halacha, Esav, Sonet, Yaakov. Halacha, it becomes like a standard. And we can't explain it. And the major theme of Purim, I just put together, Nes. You've got Mordechai and Yisrael, and Mikra, as opposed to miracle, you've got this idea of happenstance, which is represented by Haman and Amalek. And what we'll see, Bezrat Hashem, with these themes, as we've established, now running through the story next week, we'll look at Belaila Ahu, we'll begin to understand, sort of, you know, what is exactly happening, the interplay between the Machar that we saw, the elements of Amalek, the elements of Mordechai, what he's representing, the idea of Nes, all these simple events, seemingly on the surface, all come together to make this incredible, incredible confluence of miracle. And in larger terms, you know, to really see what this Megillah is trying to teach us, the idea that the hand of God is with us and is there for us, you know, at all times, in all places. I just don't know what to say. It's just too precious, this analysis. And I'm not even sure if I understand it. To go back to Yemei Bereishit, to go back to the beginning, and to see it in those terms, but I wouldn't have said that, but the Rav here says it. To be continued. Thank you very much. That was kind of interesting, I hope. I hope.